We're quite concerned. The area conditions are extremely dry. The weather is dry.
A wildfire near Anchorage endangers neighborhoods and the highway. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, July 19th. Good evening. I'm Zachariah Hughes, filling in for Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a new controversial energy plant in Juneau.
Why would we bring in a new fossil fuel monopoly when we have local, clean, abundant energy?
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
It's summer and time to get out on the water, whether you're commercial fishing, heading to a weekend cabin, or tossing in a line to catch tonight's dinner. Having a boat means regular maintenance projects, fueling, and cleaning. Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to minimize waste and pollution during these activities. Ask your harbor master for waste disposal information. Find more at alaskacleanharbors.org. This message sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
The McHugh Fire burning within the municipality of Anchorage close to the Seward Highway is now estimated at 350 acres. Earlier estimates in the day said it had grown to more than 500 acres, but fire officials downgraded the size based on better mapping. Division of Forestry spokesperson Lori Wurtsima says the main thing people need to know is to avoid the area. Traffic is backed up for 1 to 2 hours in each direction. Only a single lane is open on the Seward Highway, and motorists are being led through by pilot cars. But Wurtsima says they do not plan to close the road. The Anchorage Police Department had sent out a community-wide alert earlier in the afternoon saying a closure was possible. Crews are battling the fire to prevent it from damaging structures in the nearby neighborhoods. They are clearing vegetation around homes and laying out some pumps and hoses as preventative measures. Lindsay Fagrelius lives in Rainbow Valley, the neighborhood closest to the flames. She says she decided on her own to evacuate.
The trees and brush are so dense up there that I almost think it's hopeless. I think if it goes through, it's going to burn pretty hot.
Fagrelius, a former firefighter who had to evacuate because of the Funny River fire on the Kenai 2 years ago, says she woke up, heard the news, and started clearing brush from around the cabin she rents. Then she packed up her instruments, skis, and dogs, and headed out. She says she was worried she could get stuck if the fire moved over the road and she didn't get the notice.
That's kind of why I left, because cell reception is so crummy, I was worried that I wouldn't find out right away if there was an evacuation.
Cleo Hill is the fire marshal for Anchorage and says it's been more than 30 years since there was a fire this size near the homes along the hillside.
We're quite concerned. The area conditions are extremely dry. The weather is dry. Right now we're monitoring Rainbow Valley, which is down by the McHugh Creek fire. But should the weather change and the wind head into Anchorage, we'll be monitoring Potter Valley and the South Hillside area.
The Anchorage Police Department and the Alaska State Troopers will notify community members of any evacuations via Nixel alerts if necessary. Changing wind conditions are hard to predict and could impact the fire. Dave Snyder, a meteorologist with the National Weather Service, says the dynamic terrain along the coast where the fire is burning complicates where wind is feeding the flames and makes it tricky for crews working in the area. Snyder says conditions will likely continue to feed the fire until a new weather system arrives.
We've got a better chance of rain moving in as we get into Thursday morning, a little bit before dawn. It should start to pick up.
Snyder cautions that only about a tenth of an inch of precipitation is expected, but along with it should come more humidity and lower temperatures. A red flag warning has been issued through 10 p.m. tonight because of high winds, low humidity, and high temperatures. There's also a burn ban in place for Anchorage. Only closed barbecues and fish smokers are allowed. All this week in Ohio, the Republican National Convention is taking place, with the prime event, the nomination for president of Donald J. Trump. APRN's Liz Ruskin is reporting from Cleveland. Let's get right to it. Liz, tell me about what the order of the day was.
Well, the main business of today was nominating Donald J. Trump for president. And here's how it sounded when State Party Chairman Tuckerman Babcock called in or announced the results of the Alaska vote.
Alaska, we proudly vote exactly the way the people of Alaska voted. 12 votes for Cruz,
11 votes for Trump, 5 votes for Marco Rubio. The great state of Alaska reports exactly as our people voted, and we support the nominee of this party, Donald J. Trump.
It sounds kind of funny and old-fashioned, and it seemed like the states were outdoing each other, trying to sound more florid and more grandiose about their own state.
Switching to yesterday, Liz, one of the biggest things that happened was a speech by Donald J. Trump's wife, Melania Trump, and I gather there's been a little bit of controversy since she made her speech. Can you just recap that and tell us what, if anything, the Alaska delegates are saying about it?
Right. It's been reported in the media and certainly on social media that there's a striking resemblance between Mrs. Trump's speech and the one Michelle Obama delivered to the Democratic convention in 2008. The Alaska delegates I talked to were very skeptical that there was anything unduly similar about these two speeches. I spoke to Glenn Clary, who's a delegate. He's also the assistant pastor of Anchorage Baptist Temple. And he suggested he wanted to know if the speechwriters were the same.
You know who wrote the speech?
No.
That's what we need to find out. We need to get a copy of the speech to find out who wrote the speech. Because if that's true, that the same individual did, then that individual is responsible for that.
We do know who Michelle Obama's speechwriter was, and as of very recently anyway, she was still working for the White House, so it's highly unlikely that she also wrote Mrs. Trump's speech. But the delegates, I have to say, the delegates have been in a little bubble, pretty caught up in the convention, and they all did say that they hadn't had a chance, at least the ones I talked to compare the two speeches side by side.
The last thing I want to ask about is you have reported on a little bit of a ruckus that happened on the convention floor yesterday among some of the delegates. And I wonder if you can explain what happened and where Alaska's delegates fit into that.
Right. So the ruckus, it was essentially about rules, about whether to hold a roll call vote or a voice vote. And some of the Alaska delegates joined some very vociferous delegates from other states demanding roll call votes. And for some of the delegates, the Alaska delegates I talked to, they insisted it really just was about procedure, that they wanted roll call votes because they thought voice votes, you could have ringers in there. You know, there's a lot of people on the floor of the convention who aren't delegates, and they might be voting in a voice vote. And this all kind of harkens back to 4 years ago when Ron Paul supporters felt that they didn't get their say at the convention. So this is kind of trying to correct wrongs and hurt feelings that happened back then. On this ruckus, I talked to a few delegates today who thought the media have focused too much on the disruption, which was about 15 minutes. They were kind of embarrassed and thought that it showed the party was not united, and they thought that was unfair to show those 15 minutes of disruption to focus on them, because they thought that they got over it, you know, they got back in sync, and they thought there was too much emphasis.
That was APRN's Liz Ruskin reporting from the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. A former hockey coach at Kenai Central and Soldotna High Schools has been arrested on charges of sexually abusing minors over a span of 14 years. State troopers say they have identified 7 victims so far. 55-year-old Bradley Elliott was arrested July 13th after a search warrant was served on his Sterling home. He faces 37 counts, including sexual abuse of a minor, child pornography, and misconduct involving a controlled substance. He allegedly provided steroids to victims as a form of bribery, according to troopers. Kenai Peninsula Borough School District spokesperson Peggy Erkineff says Elliott worked at the district between 2005 to 2010 and that the district runs background checks on employees. Erkineff says that while she can't comment on whether any complaints have been filed regarding Elliott because of employee confidentiality requirements, the district does investigate complaints of this nature.
If the district receives a complaint from anybody, generally it starts at a school site, and then it would go to a director level and then potentially come to the superintendent, and there would definitely be an investigation.
Troopers say the investigation against Elliott began in December 2015 on a tip from a citizen who was concerned that Elliott had abused a family member. A Fort Wainwright soldier was found dead at his off-base home in Fairbanks on Saturday afternoon. Fairbanks police say 28-year-old Army Sergeant Philip Brandon Wright from Jacksonville, Florida, died from a self-inflicted gunshot wound. He joined the Army in 2008 and has been stationed around the United States. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, managing a fishery from the field.
I mean, it's not fun for everybody when we don't get enough fish going up the river and we have to close off districts.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The first commercial fishing opening for fall chum starts tomorrow for Marshall and Russian Mission. But still, no solution has been found for the village's broken ice machine. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
Marshall's Masurkulik Native Corporation owns the machine, but has made no effort to fix it since the compressor quit working 2 weeks ago. Replacing the part would cost $15,000. Fishermen and shareholders are meeting with Masurkulik tonight via teleconference to urge them to fix the problem. Boreal Fisheries can buy the chum, but only with the right ice. Owners Randy and Edna Crawford won't send a boat to pick up the fish unless it's in flake ice, which fishermen can't make at home and which Edna calls a necessary industry standard.
It has to be flake ice. That's the only way you're going to keep the temperature of the fish down, especially with the weather that we've had over here.
Without ice, fishermen face a tough decision. Don't fish or boat 60 miles and back to get ice from Boreal. Since the machine broke, Marshall commercial fisherman Leonard Fitka Sr. has missed two fishing openings. He's been boating the 4.5 hours to fetch ice and fears it's unsustainable.
Fishermen are working harder, staying up longer, more time away from family, hurting the economies.
Fishermen in Russian Mission travel even further for ice. Myron Edwards, a commercial fisherman there, says with gas over $4 a gallon, he wouldn't make a profit, and he doesn't know when he's going to fish next.
We're not too sure how we're going to do this. Some of us don't have enough money to pay for gas, to pitch in for one boat to go all the way to Boreal to pick up ice.
The Crawfords, who own Boreal, have known the commercial fishermen in Marshall and Russian Mission for decades, and they've built a close relationship. Boreal has provided free labor multiple times a summer to fix their ice machine. Last year, the Crawfords donated a generator. They run a small operation, and Randy Crawford says they've done all they can.
Ben and I are just really frustrated because we have put so much effort into it, and we can give no more.
Boreal pays $400,000 a year to Marshall fishermen. Randy says it's an important part of the Marshall economy, and he wants Masurkulik to invest in its community. Marshall commercial fisherman Nick Andrew Jr. has sent letters to shareholders and fishermen in Marshall and Russian Mission asking them to attend tonight's meeting.
We are imploring the Village Corporation for them to take ownership and invest in the ice machine.
The Masurkulik CEO and board members did not respond to KYUK's emails asking them about the ice machine. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Commercial salmon fishing in Alaska is closely regulated, with the Department of Fish and Game opening and closing fisheries based on calculations of the fish population. But where do they get the information to make those calls? KDLG's intern Spencer Tordoff went to a fish count tower in southwest Alaska to find out.
The fleet, thousands of fishermen, millions of sockeye, and the whole basis of the local economy flounders or flourishes based on this.
Come on. There we go. See, you can see some down there right now.
Oh, yeah. That's the sound of your average store brand tally counter. One of the primary tools used for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game's commercial harvest estimates, known here in the Bay as the count. Isaac Reynolds is one of the three-person team operating the Wood River Tower this season. He's on the evening shift, but he volunteered to show me what he and his coworkers do once per hour, all day, every day. Counting sockeye salmon as they make their way up to Lake Aleknagik.
The only times that we ever have any trouble seeing them is if it's really nasty out and the wind's just driving the water into a frenzy. But other than that, and we also count the ones who go downstream too as a negative number.
Reynolds and his teammates Minette Schwer and Alex Perio each take an 8-hour shift to keep the count running 24 hours. Only sockeye are counted at Wood River, so you have to keep a sharp eye to pick them out among other fish in the water.
And I mean, if you look down there, there's two or more right there that are also pink salmon. Generally, they're smaller. They have a different tail shape. They have a different distinctive color in the water.
The tower itself is bare scaffolding, with enough room to seat two on the top. There's one on each side of the river, and this one is about 30 feet tall, secured to the ground with ratcheted tie-down straps. There's no ladder or stairs. To get up or down, you climb the outside of the tower.
When I first got on top of that tower, I was like, oh boy.
The count is reported from here and seven other towers in Bristol Bay to Fish and Game, along with survey data, sizes and sexes of fish that are recorded a few times a day. From there, the department makes its decisions on which areas to open or close based on escapement, a target number of fish that make it up the river to spawn. Reynolds says he knows that it's painful for the fleet to be shut out of fisheries, but it's important to preserve the future of the resource.
I mean, it's not fun for everybody when we don't get enough fish going up the river and we have to close off districts. But the truth is if we didn't do that, the entire surrounding region would be at so much of a greater disadvantage.
Counting towers are expensive to run, and state budget cuts have started to threaten their operation. As government faces lean times, private groups, from processors to native associations, have stepped in to keep them staffed and counting fish for the length of the run. I'm Spencer Tordoff.
Juneau's privately owned electric utility, AEL&P, has already broken ground to build an industrial diesel plant to meet growing demand. And for the city's residents, that means the price of electricity is likely to go up. Before the development goes any further, some community members are asking the state's regulatory commission to take a closer look. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins reports.
Brian Farrell, an engineer for Juneau's electric utility, asked me to put on a blue hard hat before showing me around.
Just all our work site. We got
construction on the $22 million project began in January. And already there are two 50,000 gallon tanks installed that will feed a diesel turbine.
A diesel turbine is exactly what it sounds like. It is a combustion turbine that compresses air, injects diesel fuel as a fuel source, and ignites that to turn another turbine, which then turns a generator.
A backup generator, according to AEL&P. It could also run off liquefied natural gas, something that Avista, that's the utility's parent company, has been looking at bringing to Juneau. Right now, on a normal day, the city runs entirely off hydro. But when something goes wrong, like an avalanche takes down a power line, that service can be disrupted. That actually happened in the spring of 2008. And Farrell says when that occurs, the diesel is the backup.
We have diesel strategically placed throughout the system, and this spot is going to add greatly to that strategy.
The location for the diesel plant is in a Juneau area called the Mendenhall Valley, and the electric company says growing demand is the reason. In other words, more people powering their homes and businesses in that area. Farrell says if another catastrophe happened,
I do not have enough diesel generation in the valley to pick up all of the valley in that situation. So what that would turn into in any sort of long-term effort would be rotating blackouts for different areas of the valley.
Why would we bring in a new fossil fuel monopoly when we have local, clean, abundant energy in the form of responsible hydropower?
That's Danielle Redmond, a Juneau climate change activist. She sent a letter to the Regulatory Commission of Alaska asking for community input. To pay for the new diesel plant, the electric company will have to increase rates. And that's when the Regulatory Commission gets involved. On top of that, Redmond thinks the diesel plant doesn't reflect the city's overall values.
For me, it's more of an issue that if we continue to build infrastructure, we're not going to make investment in clean, renewable alternatives.
The city recently drafted an energy plan outlining goals for moving away from burning fossil fuels, like diesel. But Tim McLeod, AEL&P's president, says investing in renewable energy in an emergency situation doesn't make sense.
First off, diesel generation for backup is a fraction of the cost to our customers as building a new hydro would be.
In 2010, after the company completed the Lake Dorothy Hydro Project, McLeod says Juneau's electric rates went up nearly 20%. He thinks backup hydro doesn't pencil out, and would wind up costing customers more. As to how much the diesel plant will raise rates?
This will be much less than that, but I don't know what the numbers are.
AELNP has yet to file paperwork with the Regulatory Commission about the rate increase. For Danielle Redman, the problem isn't about being stuck with the bill.
May well be the case that Juneau ratepayers would be willing to pay a little bit more for additional hydropower capacity in favor of keeping new fossil fuel projects out of town.
Redman says she certainly would, but she might not have a choice in the matter. AELNP expects to have its new diesel generation plant operational by this winter. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Apollo MT by Guardian Flight, Medevac memberships that protect you or a family member when there is a need for air medical transportation. Information available at apollomt.com.
Mount Edgecombe High School in Sitka encourages rural Alaska high school students to apply to be part of their 70-year legacy. Mount Edgecombe High School provides a curriculum rich in culture and diversity, offering over 80 courses from art to advanced engineering and with activities from native dance to kayaking. Class sizes are no larger than 30. Explore your talents and develop your dreams. Apply online at mehs.us. This message sponsored by Mount Edgecombe High School.
A troublesome brown bear was shot and severely wounded by a Skagway police officer on Saturday night at a campground. The injured bear has not been seen after it hobbled into a nearby river early Sunday morning, but National Park Service officials are warning the public to be alert of a potentially dangerous situation. KHNS's Jillian Rogers has more.
The officer responded to campers, shouting and honking their car horn in an attempt to scare away the curious bear. The officer loaded his shotgun in an attempt to haze the Bruin. Hazing usually involves non-lethal rubber bullets and noisemakers meant to scare pesky wildlife. But the unnamed officer accidentally loaded the gun with a lethal slug. He hit the bear in its hind end.
And so after being shot, the bear ran away from the campground.
That's Ben Hayes, chief of interpretation for the Klondike Gold Rush National Historical Park in Skagway. He says Park Service rangers responded after the bear had been shot with the slug. Together, employees from both agencies tracked the bear for several hours.
The bear was observed swimming across the Taya River towards an island and was later tracked entering the river downstream of the island as it became dark. The bear was observed walking with great difficulty and is believed that the bear most likely succumbed to the river current as it was in a greatly weakened state.
Hayes says rangers involved reported that the bear was leaving a trail of blood behind it and moving, quote, very slowly and deliberately. Park staff and members of the police department met Monday morning to discuss the incident. There have been no further signs of the bear on the riverbank since early Sunday morning, but Hayes says it's not known for sure whether the bear actually died from its wound.
So right now we're treating the area like the bear may be still alive.
The police department is urging people in the area to be on, quote, heightened alert and call authorities immediately if the injured bear is spotted. Hayes says at the Monday meeting, the group deduced that the bear shot by police was likely the same adolescent male that's been getting into garbage in Dyea. Earlier this summer, two bears were shot by Parks Canada wildlife employees on the Canadian side of the Chilkoot Trail after a bear broke into a food storage cabin. Hayes says three bear shootings in less than a month is worrisome, but protecting the public is paramount. Reporting in Haines, I'm Jillian Rogers.
The state of Alaska uses radio collars to help find and kill wolves. The technique is part of an approved predator control effort aimed at growing the 40-mile caribou herd in the upper Yukon-Tanana area east of Fairbanks. But as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the technique raises ethical questions.
Independent biologist and wildlife advocate Rick Steiner of Anchorage is a familiar voice when it comes to Alaska wolf issues. He's long pushed the state to restore a buffer zone to protect Denali National Park wolves. But Steiner has broadened his concern and outreach to include a state predator control program in the eastern interior, where tracking technology is used to locate wolves.
This program, which virtually no one in Alaska knows about, that the state has been doing, they capture and sedate wolves and put GPS collars on them, and then use the collar to follow this wolf back to other members of its family group, which they then kill.
The radio-collared animals are sometimes called Judas wolves, a reference to the biblical story of betrayal that Steiner considers a misnomer.
Judas implies implies this intentional betrayal. But these animals are certainly not doing that. The only betrayal here, in my mind, is our state government to the people of Alaska who want ethical wildlife management.
Radio collaring has only been used for wolf control in Alaska in the upper Yukon Tanana area, according to State Director of Wildlife Conservation Bruce Dale. Dale says the approach was begun in 2011 because of the challenge of targeting wolves in the area of state and federal land.
The control area is designed to improve calf survival from the 40-mile caribou herd. So in that case, you want to take specific wolves, and in other areas, we don't want to take wolves. So the radio collars help sort that equation out.
Dale says an estimated 30% of the 179 state-killed wolves in the upper Yukon-Tanana control area over the last 5 years were taken with the assistance of radio collar tracking, a technique which he says allows airborne gunners to hone in on and dispatch wolves more quickly.
We can go right to them and take them. And, you know, our goal in any kind of reduction is to be as humane as possible.
Collared wolves are left alive to help track and potentially take out other animals in the event the lone wolf regroups with a new pack in the control area, a practice Steiner finds especially egregious given the animal's documented social nature.
Many people consider them extraordinary creatures, and here it is, that very sociality and family bond that's being exploited by the state wolf elimination and control efforts.
Steiner says he's written Governor Bill Walker asking him to end the tracking practice. Asked why the state hasn't been more out front about the program, Dale maintains the lack of publicity isn't intentional.
It was just not something that, you know, anybody thought anything of. I mean, there was certainly no effort to keep it quiet. This is commonly done in wolf reduction efforts. In lots of places where they need to keep track of the packs.
A 1992 state aerial wolf control plan that included use of tracking collars drew a tourism boycott and was called off. The technique is also used in some western lower 48 states and Canadian provinces where it's been effective and drawn critics. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found on our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Cleveland, Ellen Locke here in Anchorage, Jenny Nyman in Kenai, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Spencer Tordoff in Dillingham, Jillian Rogers in Haines, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Dan Hillman produced tonight's show. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by
GCI, serving more than 100 Alaska communities. GCI's Alaska Born and Raised campaign celebrates the people who call Alaska home. GCI.com/share your story. Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to slow down and take care with any cleaning, fueling, or painting products while maintaining your boat this summer. Be smart to save money and protect our marine environment and our beautiful ocean and coastline. Let's keep the water clean and keep our fish healthy. For more information, go to alaskacleanharbors.org. This message is sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.